This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. The U.S. Supreme Court has agreed to hear its first major case on gun laws in roughly a decade. The justices will consider a challenge to a New York state law requiring a license for anyone carrying a concealed gun in public. The law has so far been upheld by lower courts. Oral arguments are scheduled for October. The court's ruling could set new legal precedents for Second Amendment cases. You can join in on this at 800-642-1234. Do you think states or cities should have the ability to require licenses for carrying concealed guns in public? Do you think the Second Amendment permits most types of guns and where you can bring them? Or do you think there should be limits and regulations that go along with it? If you have questions about the legal precedents, call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Robert Spitzer is a distinguished service professor of political science at the State University of New York at Cortland. He's written a bunch of books on gun policy, including The Politics of Gun Control. Bob, welcome back to Central Time.
Rob, good to be with you.
Let's start with this specific law in New York and the lawsuit surrounding it. What's going on here?
Well, New York State has what's called a May issue concealed carry law, which eight states have. And it's a higher standard than many other states that have what are called shall issue laws. In a state that has a shall issue law, you can apply for a pistol permit, and as long as you're not a felon, a convicted felon, or judgmentally incompetent, or dishonorably discharged from the military, you can get the permit. In a state like New York, the bar is higher because you can be disqualified not just for if you have, let's say, been a felon, but if there are character issues at play as well. And the state conducts a more extensive background check on you than just running you through the NICS background system. And I will add that I went through the process. I have a concealed carry license in New York State, and I thought it was a perfectly reasonable process. And the law in New York has been on the books now for over a century, so that's how old this goes back. So it's one thing is clear with the Supreme Court deciding that they're going to accept hearing a challenge to the New York law. It's that they did not agree to do that just to uphold the New York law, because if they were going to do that, they would just leave it alone. So it's pretty clear that a majority of the members of the Supreme Court want to somehow, in some manner, pare back laws like those of New York.
And as I mentioned, it's been a decade or so since we had a big U.S. Supreme Court decision, as I understand it. What was the last one? What did that change?
Well, there were two major Supreme Court cases on the Second Amendment. The first was in 2008. That was District of Columbia versus Heller. That's where the Supreme Court ruled for the first time in history that the Second Amendment provided a personal right to own a handgun for personal self-protection in the home. And before that, the amendment had been interpreted by the courts and, in fact, by the people who wrote the amendment back in 1789 as having to do with citizen service in a government organized and regulated militia where the citizens had to have and get and bring their own guns. So it was a major change. And they made that change 2008. 2 years later, in a different decision, in the Chicago decision, they applied that principle to the states through something that's called incorporation. So it was the same idea, but now saying that all the states had to abide by the Heller decision of 2008. And since then, they really haven't had anything appreciable to say about the Second Amendment, even though there have been close to 100 appeals of lower court rulings on gun law cases up until this year.
What changes in the country if the Supreme Court, well, they are stepping in, if they rule against this New York concealed carry requirement?
Well, it depends on what they rule. It's pretty clear to me that several members of the court, probably a five-member majority, want to rule in some respect that there is a constitutional right to carry guns aside from self-protection, aside from your home. And that, I think, is problematic for at least a couple of reasons. One is the court itself said back in 2008 that you could regulate the carrying of guns in society. That was one of the conditions that they set out when they ruled in the Heller decision. And another problem is the fact that if you look at our actual gun law history, and the court said that gun law history matters, it's one of the things they would take into account to decide whether a current law was constitutional or not, is the fact that from starting in the late 1600s, and by the time you get up to the end of the 1800s, virtually every state in the country had laws that barred or severely restricted concealed carry of guns because they understood that it was generally not a good idea at all. And so we're at a situation now where the court seems to want to go back to an imaginary past, not our actual past, where citizens can just carry any guns they want anywhere, anytime. I don't think it'll wind up to be that extreme, but there are clearly some justices that we know from their past writings want to expand this Second Amendment right.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Jay is with us in Grant County. Jay, hello.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call. I wanted to say I absolutely believe in having mental health checks and to have what we already have, which is federal licensing of firearms as they're purchased. However, I'm always worried about continual chipping away at the Second Amendment. The Second Amendment is in the Bill of Rights. It's absolutely inherent to our rights as Americans. And it's not about having a firearm for hunting. It's not about having a firearm for personal protection necessarily. It's about having a firearm of the same grade that would help form a militia to help protect the United States of America from having internal or external strife. Please help answer my question, and I'll take my answer off the air. Thank
Jay,
you.
Thanks a lot for the call, and that's a common argument, especially more recently, Bob, that the right to bear arms, as Jay says, is to resist enemies foreign or, he's concerned, domestic.
Well, Jay raises two good points. One is he mentioned mental health checks first. One good thing about a state like New York is that it can identify people who have mental health problems but who have not actually been incarcerated for mental health reasons or not been ruled by a judge as having mental health problems. So that's, I would say, one good thing about the more extensive system in New York. As for the militia thing, Jay is referring to our history with militias, and the one important point to remember is that the militias that we had existed only when the government created them and called them up. And if we ever got to a point where, you know, the government needed to do that, of course, we have a huge standing army now. There was no such thing, you know, 200, 220 years ago. Then, you know, we would know about that and there would be ample opportunity to prepare.
Thanks for the call, Jay. We're talking to Bob Spitzer, gun policy expert, professor of political science at the State University of New York at Cortland, looking at a new gun law case going to the Supreme Court later this year. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think states should be able to require licenses for carrying a firearm in public? How strict could those be, do you think? What questions do you have about the legal precedent in Second Amendment cases? Call 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Bob Spitzer, political science professor, author of several books on gun policy, looking at the U.S. Supreme Court's decision to consider a legal challenge to a New York state law on carrying firearms concealed in public, a case that could have big Second Amendment implications. Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Cindy is with us in Appleton. Cindy, hi.
Hello. Well, I don't understand this whole gun thing going back to the Wild West of the 1800s. I don't think carrying a gun makes anybody any safer. And what about my rights? How come I don't have any rights as a person who doesn't want to carry a gun, has no use for a gun? I don't feel safe sitting in restaurants and theaters anymore with people that could be packing next to me. What about my rights?
Cindy, thanks for the call. Bob, the balancing concerns of someone like Cindy who's worried about safety if there are guns around.
Well, yeah, and there's two parts to this. One part is the fact that from all sorts of studies, we pretty much know that when civilians are carrying their own guns, it's statistically less likely to make people safe than more safe in terms of, you know, accidental discharges, dropping firearms, losing firearms, having children or the depressed take them and use them in a bad way, things like that. And the other thing is that firearms are innately intimidating. We have had laws on the books for hundreds of years against brandishing of weapons. And that's what those laws are. And we had weapons against, laws against brandishing going back to the 1600s for the very reason that Cindy says.
Thanks for the call, Cindy. We'll go to Blake now in Madison. Blake, hi.
Hello. My question for the expert is how we need to maybe dismantle some of these laws. The language they use, I feel, is rooted in a lot of, I want to say, racist roots. I'm a person of color who lives in Madison, and I feel safer being armed and knowing that I hold some control over my own life. I feel like it's a very privileged point of view to think that giving all the power away to people in your social group is an okay thing. I'll take my answer out there.
Blake, thanks for the call. We could have a whole conversation, Bob, about race and gun control from Southern Civil War veterans being better armed than black people in the South or the Black Panthers in California openly carrying firearms, leading Ronald Reagan to support gun control laws. Your thoughts on what Blake had to say?
Well, that is part of the history and part of the past. There's no doubt about that. But race was not the main reason for gun regulations in the past. Certainly when you had Governor Reagan back in the 60s saying, oh, we better have stricter gun laws because of the Black Panthers, that was a real thing, and that was race-based. But gun laws don't exist or didn't exist historically mainly for racial reasons. They existed mostly for safety reasons. And the key problem for African Americans in the past, in the post-Civil War South and on, was not that they were deprived of the right to have guns, because in fact there were black militias, but because they were outgunned and outmanned by the white majority. And it was a foregone conclusion who was going to win a gun battle between smaller numbers of African Americans trying to assert their freedom and protect themselves and larger numbers of a white racist society.
Thanks a lot for that call, Blake. In just our last minute, Bob, we'll have a ways to wait before the Supreme Court hears this case. Briefly, what are you watching for from the president and Congress when it comes to possible changes in gun law?
Well, President Biden is moving ahead with several executive orders that actually I think are fairly important. Congress has several measures before it. The House of Representatives has passed three bills that are before the Senate now. The key question is, what's the Senate going to do? And that kind of depends on the filibuster and how the public views this. So there's a lot happening in this area. The Supreme Court's going to have oral argument on this gun case in October, and we'll get a decision from them probably next spring.
Bob, thanks a lot for joining us again today.
You bet. Good to speak to you.
Robert Spitzer is a professor of political science at the State University of New York at Cortland. He talked to us about a legal challenge to a New York gun regulation. It's headed to the U.S. Supreme Court, and about what it could all mean for how we apply the Second Amendment. Coming up after the news, we'll spend some time in space, from new pictures from the Hubble telescope to the latest from Mars. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Now we turn our attention upwards and outwards to space. There's a lot happening in our solar system lately, from astronauts making their way to the International Space Station to a birthday card from the Hubble telescope. David Eicher is editor-in-chief of Astronomy Magazine, which is based in Waukesha. David, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure.
Well, let's start with something on the more sad side, and you wrote about this, that astronaut Michael Collins passed away this week at the age of 90. He played a huge role in the Apollo 11 mission. David, could you tell us some about Michael Collins?
It is a very sad day yesterday, in that he was really a wonderful guy and a funny man, and of course very smart, being the command module pilot for that first lunar landing, Apollo 11. He was a great guy, and everyone in the world who ever met Mike Collins after 1969 asked him, weren't you the loneliest guy in the universe when Armstrong and Aldrin were down on the lunar surface and you weren't? And he told me a number of times, no, I really loved being up in the capsule and sort of looking over the mission. And he wasn't worried about himself. He was worried about the fact that the lunar module engine, might not start, and that Armstrong and Aldrin, his two pals, may permanently be on the lunar surface. But he was a really wonderful guy, and it's a sad thing that we've gotten to know some of these Apollo fellows so well, and we're losing them slowly here because they're up there in age. But he was a great man, hero.
And this is a guy who's done one of the most unique things in the world, right? He took a couple spins around the moon as part of the landing. Did he talk about it as this sort of like monumental experience, or was it, you know, was it his job? Did he, this is just what we do.
You know, the enormity of it and the significance to humanity, I think, was not lost on these guys. Every one of them, you talk to the Apollo astronauts, they, to a man, talked about holding up their thumb at arm's length and being able to block Earth, you know, and that little tiny planet where all of human history, everything that we know, everything that we've experienced throughout the whole of our civilization is blotted out by your thumb. You know, what a tiny little place in the universe it was. But these guys were professionals. They were very slick. They were doing their jobs. They were cool as ice, doing what had to be done to take care of business. So they were both sort of human, but exceptionally calm, professional scientists and engineers.
Well, and then here we are this week for more professionals. Four astronauts made it to the International Space Station on board SpaceX's Crew Dragon capsule Endeavour. Now, this is a recycled capsule. Got another use. Why is that a big deal?
Well, it's a big deal in that we have really a new age of public and private space exploration, and we have the capability now, without other nations being involved, of getting people up to the station and on beyond, because we hope, of course, in a few years to go back to the moon and maybe eventually go to Mars, which is going to be an incredibly complex and expensive and multinational mission that really will require the kinds of money where multiple nations and public and private companies will have to work with governments. So Elon Musk, yeah, leading the way, and others, Bezos and others, that's really an important, significant thing to test these engineering steps to have the capability to get back to where we were with Mike Collins 50 years ago and go beyond that point.
And speaking of international cooperation, this was an international crew, right? U.S., Japan, and I think France all represented in this four-person crew?
That's right. Exactly right. And so there's a group that's coming back due to splashdown. They were delayed a little bit on Saturday in the Atlantic near Florida. But this is an international – both groups were international. There was a Japanese astronaut on each of the two, and one of the groups contained a European Union member as well from France, as you mentioned. So, you know, that kind of international cooperation, it's going to have to be the way to get deeper into space, because as Douglas Adams said many years ago, space is really, really big and it's dangerous. And so we need all of humanity to work together.
Talking to David Eicher, editor-in-chief of Astronomy Magazine, looking at some of the latest big news from space, near and far. And here's a story that combines both of those, David. Hubble, nearby in our Earth orbit here, celebrated its 31st birthday. Lots of pictures in that 31 years. And I guess on the actual birthday, it sent us this pretty unique stellar photograph. Well, what did we see?
It did. And of course, it's been the workhorse for astronomy over the last generation. It's done more than any other instrument to increase our understanding of the universe by orders of magnitude. It's a great achievement and a great anniversary. And it's nice that after 31 years, it's still going strong, too. But it looked at a star, a very funny star called AG Carinae, which is a so-called luminous blue variable. Now, this is a very big, massive star that is about 100 times larger than our sun. It's about a million times brighter than the sun. It's one of the brightest stars in our Milky Way galaxy, which has about 400 billion stars in it. And it's unstable. It's late in its life, and it's going from what astronomers call a supergiant star to a strange kind of critter that's called a Wolf-Rayet star. And that is when the atmosphere of this star strips off and it radiates, it sears the surrounding space in radiation, and it's creating a nebula that's expanding, that is glowing, and a shell that you can see. And that's what this beautiful picture that you can see on the Hubble site is all about.
And David, you and I have talked in the past about Hubble, and I've heard, I think, from you and from some others that astronomy you can kind of divide into before Hubble and after Hubble in some ways. How much has this revolutionized our view of the cosmos?
Well, that's right. I mean, it's really incalculable because we've had an enormous history of astronomy, you know, and of astrophysics, of understanding the physics behind the objects rather than just cataloging them for 150 years. But really, Hubble has taken us to a new understanding of the age, of the size, of the fate of the universe, of how the earliest galaxies and stars likely formed, of what will happen to our solar system. The whole picture, we're really in a golden age of understanding how the universe works more than ever before. And a large part of that is because of the last generation and the Hubble Space Telescope.
Well, let's get back closer to home now on Mars. We've got the rover there, of course, and now we've got this Ingenuity little mini chopper guy. It's had three successful flights so far. I think I saw earlier today the fourth one delayed. Can you talk about what this could lead to on Mars?
It had a little technological glitch this morning. It was supposed to have a fourth flight, and there was a little hiccup in the software. I don't think it's anything to worry about. But this is really a technology demonstration with this little tiny helicopter, which appropriately is landing on a little spot near the Jezero crater that's being explored, called Wright Brothers Field. They call it. This is the first flight on another planet in history other than Earth. And it's a little tiny craft. It's a 4-pound, 2-foot-high craft, roughly. And what they're doing is simply testing a flight which will aid in the future other missions to be able to image the planet, to understand the mineralogy around on Mars, and, of course, lead us to the ultimate question: could there have been life in the water that existed on Mars on the surface a long time ago? So this is really a sort of a technological test. It's hard because the Martian atmosphere is much thinner than Earth, so it's tricky. And so we have to have a small energetic craft to do it. But it looks like, with the exception of a small slip this morning, that everything is going pretty well for Ingenuity.
And speaking of Mars, China has, I think it's in orbit now around Mars, their own rover. They're aiming to land it next month. What do we know about their expedition?
Well, I'll tell you, I was at a meeting a few years ago, and there was a fellow from the Chinese Space Agency who was an official there, and China has an unbelievably ambitious, incredibly expensive suite of missions planned to basically do what the entire Western world has done for themselves. So China will push ahead, I think, with these missions, and in a sort of an analogous track, compete with what Western nations have done and try to learn a lot about their own planetary science program. And we can hope, of course, in the future that there's a lot of sharing. Scientists tend to be apolitical and share data and work together. So I hope that will happen here between the West and with China. But they're very ambitious, they're serious, and they're shoveling an enormous amount of money into these projects.
And another topic we've talked about some before, David, exoplanets. We're spotting more and more planets and solar systems outside our own. And one thing, I saw a piece on this, one thing that research has been looking for is oxygen in the atmosphere as a likely sign of potentially planets that could support life. And some argument about whether that's really a sure sign. What are we looking for out there?
Well, that's right. You're exactly right. And of course, this is another huge cottage industry in astronomy that has really only taken place in the last generation. Now, we know of more than 4,700 planets orbiting other stars, stars other than the sun around us in our galaxy. And of course, oxygen is a major tracer for life on Earth. When there were enough microbes 2.6 billion years ago, finally on our planet, they became very plentiful. We had an explosion in oxygen on Earth, and that changed Earth and its atmosphere, its chemistry, its mineralogy, everything. It made life flourish then, which included us. So astronomers look for biosignatures, they call them. That is, in the light of these, in the spectra of these worlds, clues that maybe there is a lot of a particular kind of gas like oxygen that would favor life. But there's a new study, as you said, that sort of contradicts the hopes for looking for oxygen around on these planets. Maybe you could have very watery worlds that don't have life. Maybe you could have dry desert worlds that have a steamy atmosphere. nonetheless because of their chemistry. Maybe you could have worlds that have a very high carbon dioxide to water ratio. That would create a sort of a runaway greenhouse effect, what we have on Venus here in our solar system. That would keep a lot of oxygen mixed up in the atmosphere, maybe without living beings. So we have to be careful about seeing something. They're so far away, these stars. We're not going to, walk out of a spacecraft onto them. So if we detect life, it's going to have to be with radio signals of intelligence, or we're going to have to try to detect it chemically like this from exoplanets. So this gives us some pause about what we conclude.
As we wrap up, David, cloudy right now, but are there any celestial events that we can observe in our night sky coming up anytime soon?
Oh, boy. Well, there are meteors going on right now. There are frequent meteor showers, and in August is the best one. That's a good one to sort of get into observational astronomy in mid-August, the Perseid meteors. And, of course, you can see there we just had a very bright full moon a couple nights ago, and we've got some big things like eclipses of the sun and moon coming later this year that will be very exciting as well.
Probably talk to you again when that happens. David, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
David Eicher is the editor-in-chief of Astronomy Magazine, which is based in Waukesha. He joined us to talk about the latest news about space.